Last week we talked about the use of the term Babylon. The destruction of Babylon was prophesied by a couple of angels in the 14th chapter. And we talked about what we thought that referred to. And the conclusion that I came to, that I think many other scholars have come to as well, it's not the only choice, is that that Babylon refers to Jerusalem. But it wasn't called Jerusalem for some reason that isn't perfectly clear, except that the term Babylon means confused. And obviously the Jews were quite confused about the Messiah and had made some terrible mistakes in their treatment of Jesus. Some people have asked, is this all written in a book somewhere? And yes, it is, and I have about a half a dozen copies of the book that I wrote about 12 years ago. And I haven't changed much in my views of what all of this means, which I think is reasonably encouraging that maybe I'm just stuck in a rut and I don't want to change it. But I think I've upgraded a few comments along the way, but I really haven't changed the whole concept. If anyone's interested, see me after class. Tonight, we're gonna follow along in the historic view of what these scriptures are all about. Remember, we started with creation back in chapter 4, came through the flood, came through the giving of the law in chapter 10, and on down through the prophets to the time of Christ and his crucifixion, and now that was announced by the verses that were taken by Handel in setting up the Messiah. What did he say? The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ. And that's, of course, in the 12th chapter. The 13th chapter had to do about God's view of this terrible beast which had been plaguing humanity from before the time of Daniel. The desire to have a world empire that different countries had undertaken and different men had undertaken to try to control all of humanity. And obviously the devil was behind that. And so that beast, of course, in the time of Christ was Rome. And the 13th chapter has to do a lot with the way Rome was treating its citizens, particularly Christians. And if Christians didn't adhere to all of the rules and regulations that were copied, incidentally, maybe inadvertently, but clearly copied by the establishment in Jerusalem, they were just as domineering of their population as Rome had been, or still was. And so that was the beast. If you bowed to the beast and succumbed to his rules and regulations, you were to be condemned along with Babylon when Babylon was destroyed. We talked about that last week. And then in the 14th chapter of the 14th verse of the 14th chapter, we come to something that in many Bibles is headed the harvest of the earth. Back at the start of the class, I told you that I thought that Burton Kaufman was right, that the sea in these images that we see are the pagan, atheistic nations of the world, and the earth can also be is also the Greek word for land. The land was, when God talked about it, was the land of Israel. And so tonight we're going to talk about the harvest of Israel, the harvest of the earth. I think that's what we're talking about. We'll see that in just a minute. It really supports that concept as we look at these particular scriptures. So, with that kind of a review as to where we are, Chapter 14, verse 14, John says, I looked, there before me was a white cloud, and seated on the cloud was one like a son of man with a crown of gold on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. It's the only verse of scripture, I guess, in the Bible where it talks about someone sitting on a cloud. And yet that concept for angels is rampant throughout all of the illustrations that you see in papers. Individuals with wings and harps and a halo walking on and sitting on clouds. But there's an interesting set of words here that suggest who this is. One like a son of man. And who was called the son of man? He called himself that. Jesus, yeah. And he has a crown of gold on his head. And it's the crown here, a Stephanon, having accomplished something. And a sharp sickle in his hand. What's a sickle? All of you urban groups may not know, be familiar with the implements of farming, but a sickle is the implement depicted here. What do you do with a sickle? You can mow the grass with it if you want to. It's a laborious process. But you swing the sickle through the stalks of a plant, and it cuts them very, very readily, doesn't it? The shape of it is designed to cut through the wheat or the grain, whatever grain you're growing, and to cut them off at a uniform level from the ground. There are sickles that are larger than that are swung. I don't know. It's the old style weed eater unmotorized. What's that thing called? A what? It's a scythe? Yeah, okay. And I think actually I've owned one in the past. And that one you swing like a golf club and cut the grass and the weeds and so on with it. So they had these various implements, and the sickle is to harvest the wheat or the oats or whatever grain, barley, that they were growing. And then he says, then another angel came out of the temple. Now, if you go back, there have been angels in the earlier verses leading up to this that have appeared and made announcements. So came out of the temple. What temple are we talking about here? This is a temple in heaven. And it has angels coming and going, and within it apparently is a place where God dwells, and we have voices from the temple from time to time. So this angel, now every time you see the word angel, doesn't tell you if it's Jesus or what we've called a generic angel. The word, it simply means a messenger. Another messenger came out of the temple and called in a loud voice to him who was sitting on the cloud, take your sickle and reap, because the time to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. So he that was seated on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was harvested. And the earth, I think, here means Israel. Swung his sickle over Israel, and Israel was harvested. What's he doing here? Is this a judgment, the end of the world, and these are people being taken to heaven? Are these good people or bad people? Or is there any discrimination here? Well, if you think about the word reap, what does that suggest? What do you reap? Do you reap the weeds? If you sowed weeds, I guess you'd reap the weeds, but weeds aren't very useful, are you? You reap a harvest, and so it's the good part, isn't it? It's the good part of the earth that he's reaping here. And if we look at other references in the Bible, we come to the realization that the word reap doesn't necessarily mean that people are dead or going to heaven or anything like that. Remember in John 4 when Jesus talked to the woman at the well? The disciples came back bringing him food, but he didn't eat any of the food they brought. He said, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. Do you not say 4 months more and then the harvest? I tell you, open your eyes and look at the fields. They are ripe for harvest. Even now the reaper draws his wages, and now he harvests the crop for eternal life, so that the sower and the reaper may be glad together. Thus the saying, 'One sows and another reaps,' is true. I sent you to reap what you have not worked for. Others have done the hard work, and you have reaped the benefits of their labor." What's he talking about there about a crop that's the fields are ripe? If he's looking at a wheat field, then the grains turn golden and it looks like it's ready to harvest. What's he talking about here, though? What he's talking about here, though, is not the grain itself. What's he talking about? That's right. The people in Samaria who've been impressed with what this woman told them, and they're coming out to meet the Messiah. Can he be the one? Can he be? What was her comment about his knowledge of her? He told me, she felt like he knows everything I ever did. So the reaper here is, when was this harvest reaped actually? You remember? After, you go over to the book of Acts, after the crucifixion, the resurrection, and the ascension, Philip goes to Samaria, and he reaps a great harvest. What do you mean by that? He converted a lot of people, didn't he? They believed the teaching about Jesus, and a large number of people became Christians. And so, reaping doesn't necessarily have the... We have this vision in our head about the grim reaper. Yeah, well, that's not what we're talking about here, okay? We're talking about a harvest of good. And so, Jesus was the one sitting on the cloud, and he's going to reap Israel. And so, we've got to figure out what that means. Now, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, Luke 21, and it's also in Matthew 24 and a couple of other places in the Bible, allusions to this event. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, and that's what we're about to see in the next chapters, you will know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those in the city get out. Let those in the country not enter the city. For this is the time of punishment and fulfillment of all that has been written. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. There will be great distress in the land and wrath against this people. And so we're coming up in the next chapter on the God's wrath unleashed against Babylon, which is Jerusalem. There will be great distress and wrath against this people. They will fall by the sword, so you know how that's going to take place, and will be taken as prisoners to all the nations. Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And so he gives a warning here in verse 21. When you see the sign, what's the sign? Jerusalem surrounded by armies. What do? You leave. You get out. When you see the armies coming, before the siege is set up, if possible, you get out and flee to the mountains or flee away from the city. If you're out in the country, don't go back to the city. Run away. And it's said, historically, that at the siege of Jerusalem, no Christians lost their lives. And how many Christians were in Jerusalem at the time? large numbers, weren't there? There had been large numbers. The Jerusalem church was a very large church. But they all left when they saw this sign. And history tells us that they fled to Pella, which is down southeast of the Sea of the Dead Sea, and waited there out of the, evidently moved there, out of the field of battle, and were safe. And so could it be that harvesting the earth, taking the good from Israel, and moving them to a safe place is what we're talking about here. Now another angel came out. We'll look at a verse of scripture that supports that in a minute. Another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. Still another angel who had charge of the fire came from the altar and called in a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, "Take your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of grapes from the earth's vine," from Israel's vine, "because its grapes are ripe." The angel swung his sickle on the earth, on Israel, gathered its grapes and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. That doesn't sound good, does it? They were trampled in the winepress from outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press, rising as high as the horses' bridles, for a distance of 1,600 stadia, essentially the area, the entire area of Israel. It's a large distance. I've forgotten how long a stadia is. Do we have any engineers who know Greek stadia as to how far that is? But it's a good distance. 800 miles. 180 miles. Okay. There's somebody's footnote. Thank you, Jennifer. So grapes are different from the harvest. And that has been used in Joel, for example. "Swing the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come trample the grapes, for the winepress is full and the vats overflow. So great is their wickedness." So that figure is used in harvesting the wicked. And that seems to be the contrast that we're looking at here in Revelation. Harvesting the wheat, and then harvesting the grapes. And it reminds us of the story in Matthew 13, where Jesus told this parable of an enemy that came and sowed weeds in the field of the owner of a farm. And when the wheat and the weeds came up, they realized that there were weeds in the field. And so the servants came and asked the owner, "Do you want us to go and pull them up?" And he answered, "No, because while you're pulling the weeds, you may root up the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest, and at that time I'll tell the harvesters, first collect the weeds and tie them in bundles to be burned, and then gather the wheat and bring it into my barn." As the weeds are pulled up, down in verse 40, he's explaining this to his disciples. As the weeds are pulled up and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age. Now, the order in which this happens here is, what does the owner tell them to do? Pull which? The weeds first, and then harvest the wheat. Whereas in the order that we have in Revelation, it's the sickle for the wheat comes first, and then harvesting the grapes, which correspond here to the weeds. But notice that what happens to the weeds, they're tied in bundles. They aren't destroyed right away. After the wheat's harvest, then they are burned, apparently. So the order probably doesn't mean much. But here's good and bad in Israel harvested separately. And further on down, we get a clue as to what's going on here. If we go to chapter 15 and read, "I saw in heaven another great and marvelous sign, seven angels with the seven last plagues, last because with them God's wrath is completed. And in verse 2, I saw what looked like a sea of glass mixed with fire. A sea of glass mixed with fire. The sea normally in John's symbolism, in God's symbolism to John, means the pagan nations of the world. And if it's mixed with fire, what does that suggest? Armies and battle and disruption and all going on among the pagan nations. And standing beside the sea, now they're not in the sea, they're away from the sea a little bit, those who had been victorious over the beast and his image and over the number of his name. And that sounds like the people in Israel who had not bowed to the idol, recall, that the sea beast had made, and or that the land beast had made of the sea beast. And so they weren't serving atheistic government. And so those would be the ones who were following God, wouldn't it? And so they're standing beside the sea. They held harps given them by God, and of course that's symbolic of music, and sang the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb. And that's two songs. If they sang the song of Moses, where would you find some songs of Moses? Any idea? Those of you who are reading your Bible through should have. Pardon me? Well, and Exodus at the time of the crossing of the Gulf of Aqaba, when Egyptian army was drowned in the sea, then Moses composed a little song there, didn't he? And also, another song of Moses is recorded in the Psalms, Psalm 90. So that suggests that we're talking, those who sing the song of Moses, we're talking about Jewish people here. And the song of the Lamb would suggest that they are also what? They're also Christians, aren't they? So the Jewish Christians who had been rescued from Jerusalem are now down south of the Dead Sea somewhere, and they're rejoicing in their own salvation here and praising God. Great and marvelous are your deeds, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are your ways, King of the ages. Who will not fear you, O Lord, and bring glory to your name? For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship before you, and your righteous acts have been revealed. And so although they are Jewish Christians, they recognize the fact that Christianity is not just for Jews, but for everyone, right? So I think the fact that they sang these two songs tells you who these people are, and they've been rescued from Jerusalem, and I think that was the harvest of the wheat, the good, out of Israel. They left Jerusalem before the battle began and before Jerusalem was destroyed. Now, if you go back and think about the grapes, they're the ones who weren't following God, didn't do what God asked them to do. They were the ones who cried out to Pilate when Pilate says, "I'm innocent of this man's blood." Remember, he washed his hands. And they said, "Let his blood be on whom? On us and our children." And that's what's about to happen. Well, there's an interesting thing. I'm going to back up a couple of here and look at this verse 20 for a minute. The grapes were put into the wine press. What's a wine press? It's some kind of a mechanism where you can press grapes and squeeze out the juice, right? And how was that normally run? It was run with human feet, wasn't it? And they trampled the grapes in a big vat. And the liquid was poured out of a spout to one side into vessels of some sort, and that was the beginning process of for making wine. And so there is the great winepress of God's wrath, which I think is the city of Jerusalem. They're stuck in there, surrounded by Vespasian and Titus's armies from Rome, and they're going to be destroyed there. But there's this word down here, they were trampled in the winepress outside the city, and that's the NIV. And that bothered me a little bit, because they would be trampled in the winepress inside the city, wouldn't they? If we're right here. But the word there for outside is exo. We use that as a prefix in a lot of words. But there's an ambiguity here, because some of the manuscripts have the word exothen. Theta E-N added to it. And some manuscripts had one, some had the other. And a man named Nestle sorted out the Greek from many, many manuscripts over 100 years ago and came to the conclusion that the word exothen belonged here rather than exo. And the difference is that exothen has also the connotation of from outside. And if you turn to Luke chapter 7, verse 17. Now, wait, is that the right place? I thought sure that was it, but I don't think it is. Anyway, where Jesus is talking about, let me see if I can find it. Maybe it's Luke 17, but I don't think so. Might have the verse backward. Okay, what I'm looking for is the verse where he talks about a man being defiled, not defiled by what he eats. A man cannot be defiled from the outside. It's what comes from within him that defiles him. And the word exothen is used there as well in that context, from outside. Well, I thought I had that verse. Oh, I'm sorry, it's not Luke, it's Mark. That's why I'm off base here. Yeah, Mark 7:17. After he left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about this parable. Are you so dull? He asked. Don't you see that nothing that enters a man from the outside, that's exothen, can make him unclean? For it doesn't go into his heart and into his stomach and then out of his body. So the term there is the same as the one in Revelation, apparently, and means from the outside. That would mean that the soldiers outside came to the inside and trampled the city. Well, it's a minor point, even at best. But I don't think this is a contradiction. So, here we have the praise given by the Jewish Christians gathered at the southern end of the Dead Sea as they're safe from the battle that's going to destroy Jerusalem. I think that's a term, that's an idiom, like we would use when we say someone was in over his head. Not necessarily 6 feet deep into some problem, but deep. I expect that's, what do we call that? Not an exaggeration necessarily, but to make a point that it was deep for a long distance away. Now, as the battle proceeds, and we're going to go through this, destruction of Israel by Titus's army, and that's, we're a week ahead of our schedule that I gave you at the beginning of the course, and so we have an extra week now, next week, and then the second Wednesday of April. Those two Wednesdays will cover chapters 16, 17, and 18 in Revelation. And that's all of those have to do with the destruction of Jerusalem. And it's gory in some ways, and it's really disheartening to think about the destruction of so many people in such they were embedded in so much misery because of what was happening to them, but they brought it on themselves. They always had a choice. And so we're going to spend a few minutes looking at that. I want to get this last set of verses from chapter 15. After this I looked, and in heaven the temple, that is the tabernacle of testimony. You see, the one that Moses built was a copy of the one that was in Revelation. That's mentioned here, that was in heaven. Now it's opened. Remember, it was opened back at the end of chapter 12, wasn't it? After Jesus had gone back and John could see the Ark of the Covenant in that temple at the time. Out of the temple came seven angels with seven plagues. They were dressed in clean, shining linen and wore golden sashes around their chests. Then one of the four living creatures gave to the seven angels seven golden bowls filled with the wrath of God who lives forever and ever. Last week we talked about how that the wine of God's wrath was to be delivered not only to Jerusalem but to the nations around Jerusalem at the time of the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem. And so here's a replay of that event. Bowls filled with the wrath of God. And if you had a bowl, how could you fill it with your wrath? It's obviously some extreme symbolism here, isn't it? And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from His power. Remember, at the dedication of the temple by Solomon, they took the Ark of the Covenant in, and then it filled with the glory of God, and nobody could go back in, and the priests couldn't do their duties, could they? Excuse me. And no one could enter the temple until the seven plagues of the seven angels were completed. And the implications of that are extreme. What does that mean? No one could enter. Why would anybody want to enter the temple under these circumstances? I'm sorry? Plead for mercy. Appeal to God to forestall his destruction. But this indicates that the decision is final. Nobody's going to be allowed to appeal it. There's not any way that anybody could do anything to forestall the destruction that's about to fall upon Israel. And God has determined finally once and for all that this would be the case. And remember back at the beginning of that paragraph, these are the seven last plagues because with them God's wrath is completed. Wrath against Israel. Is God mad at Israel today? Don't really think, not in the way he was then, is he? These are different people, different context, a different world. And I think he treats Jerusalem just like he treats all the other nations. They're not a protected and chosen people anymore like they had been up until this time. Now, that concludes chapter 15, and when we get into chapter 16, we're going to see these bowls poured out one after the other. And they're symbolic of some events that occurred as this army from Rome marches across the country and destroys city after city after city, unless they capitulated, in which case he would spare the city but place them under a strong and difficult taskmaster. And so we're going to look at these as they happen one after the other, and the story of how this happened is recorded by one man, essentially. And that's the handout that I gave you, and I want to spend the last few minutes teaching you a little bit about Flavius Josephus. Do any of you have Josephus's writings? A few of you do. And most of them, I hope some of you have a modern speech translation of it, because I think there is such a thing now. What I have is Whiston's translation, which came about, oh, I don't know, 100 years ago maybe. I don't know the exact time. And so Flavius Josephus is the name he took when he was under the Roman rule. His original name had been Joseph ben Matthias, a.k.a. stands for also known as, right. Now, I'm just going to read through this paragraph, which is the first paragraph on one side of the handout that I gave you. One side of the handout is something off the internet which sort of summarizes his life, and it's a pretty good summary, and I think it'll give you an idea of who he was. What we're looking at here is his preface to his writings. And when you read this, it's very easy to get lost, but I want to give you a little clue that will help you in reading it. Whereas the war which the Jews made with the Romans hath been the greatest of all those, not only that have been in our times, but in a matter of those that ever were heard of, both of those wherein cities have fought against cities or nations against nations, while some men who were not concerned in the affair themselves have gotten together vain and contradictory stories by hearsay and have written them down after a sophistical manner. Isn't that a neat word? And while those that were there present have given false accounts of things, and this either out of a humor of flattery to the Romans or of hatred to the Jews. Now this language, as you read it, reminds you of a certain type of writing that you may encounter from time to time in our modern day. What? Whereas, and while this, and thus. It sounds like legalese, doesn't it? Yeah, and he writes that way. But you'll notice that this is one long sentence, and it goes on into the next slide in a minute. We'll get there. But if you will read it, break it up as you read it, and every time you come to a semicolon, like at the end of the word nations on the fifth line, stick a period there and drop the while in the next one, and then just make a sentence out of those. And what you have is a topical sentence to begin with and then supportive sentences in the following, which is the way we write prose in our day and age. And I suspect that's how it's written, although I haven't seen the modern translations. I imagine that's what they would do. So, The war which the Jews made with the Romans has been the greatest of all those, not only that have been in our times, but in a manner of those that have ever been heard of. And I'm talking both of those wherein cities have fought against cities or nations against nations. Some men who were not concerned. See, leave out the whiles and wherefores and so on, because that's just the tying conjunctions that he's using in this. And then it makes a more reasonable paragraph. And while their writings contain sometimes accusations and sometimes encomiums. What's an encomium? Pardon me? Somebody know? If he's talking about two contrasts here, sometimes accusations, and that would be saying, well, so-and-so didn't know what they were talking about and made a bunch of mistakes, or sometimes encomiums. You can look that up. You can pull out your BlackBerry or your iPhone and get your dictionary and look that up. It's in the Bible. It's praise for having made all the right decisions, see? An encomium is a high praise, okay? But nowhere the accurate truth of the facts, see? He's saying they go to one extreme or the other, but they don't know what they're talking about. I have proposed to myself, for the sake of such as live under the government of the Romans, to translate these books into the Greek tongue. And so he set about to translate some books that he had written earlier. And he's going to put them in Greek for the benefit of the Romans, who all spoke Greek, which I formerly composed in the language of our own country. That is, he had written it first in Aramaic and sent to the upper barbarians. Oh boy, who are the upper barbarians? There must be lower barbarians as well, would you suppose? And so the upper barbarians are the Arab nations around Israel, and the Babylonians and the Syrians and the Assyrians, those that were left of them, and particularly the Jews in all of these that had been scattered in all of these countries, basically for the benefit of the Jews, because they would be the ones. But those were the nations that spoke Aramaic. I, Joseph, the son of Matthias, by birth a Hebrew, a priest also, and one who at first fought against the Romans myself. See, he was a general in the Jewish army and was eventually captured and was forced to be present at what was done afterwards. And then the implication is, I am the author of this work. Already to start with. But it reminds you of the introduction to a book of the Bible. A person who was much more economical of the words but makes some of the same points. Who? If you turn to Luke in his gospel, he begins with a paragraph explaining why he's writing it and to whom he's writing it, and that obviously Theophilus had heard about these things. He's going to try to set things straight. And that's really what Josephus is about here. Yep. That's right. Yeah, he's saying, well, I had to go. I had to do this. The story of how he came to be successful in this event. He was a captured general and put in prison, of course. And it's interesting that he survived. Several of these leaders had hidden in a cave and had an agreement among them for suicide, a suicide pact. And somehow he's the sole survivor of a suicide pact. So there's kind of an interesting turn of events. You wonder how he was convinced to do that. And so he was in prison. But he had a chance to talk to Vespasian, who was the general of the Roman army. And he showed him some prophecies from the Old Testament, convinced that Vespasian was the one who was going to be made Caesar, the next Caesar of the Romans. And Vespasian blew him off. But as it turned out, when that happened, Vespasian remembered that he had done that, had said this, and how that came to pass is kind of interesting too. There was a war going on back home, disruption about who's, when Nero died, who's going to take his place. Nero committed suicide. And when and so there were two more men who were counted as Caesar's before we get to Vespasian. But they were kind of hated by the Roman army, and the army under his control elected him Caesar against his will. And so he went back to solidify things at Rome and came out victorious over Otho, and there's one other. I can't remember the other. They only served for a few months each. And so he was the next big Caesar of the Romans. And so he was so impressed by the fact that Josephus had predicted this that he set him free, gave him his freedom, and gave him the job of recording all of these things, which he did first in Aramaic and then later translated them and made a few corrections as he translated. We don't have the Aramaic version, I guess. We only have the Greek version. But the Greek version survived things like the burning of the library at Alexandria, and where a lot of ancient documents were lost. But the Romans evidently kept this because they were impressed by the thoroughness of this history of the war against the Jews. And then he also wrote a summary and paraphrase of the Old Testament, which is called the Antiquities of the Jews, and several other minor documents as well. So you can read about that on the other side of the page there. Now, that was, I wanted to point out how that was set up. That was number one. Notice at the start, that's the first verse, ran through the whole paragraph. But actually, he's numbering his paragraphs. He's not, there may be several sentences in a paragraph, although they tend to be very long ones. And so you can find things in Josephus by looking at one of his seven books about the war. And then in each one, you can look down to find a paragraph. You can find chapters, and then you can find a paragraph. So there are three numbers you have to have in order to find something in his books. So number two, now at this time when this great concussion of affairs, what's a concussion? Well, we talked about athletes who have concussions. What does that mean? They collide. Yeah, it's a collision, isn't it? It's a big blow of some sort. And when this big blow of affairs happened, the affairs of the Romans themselves were in great disorder, as he starts out his second paragraph. And you got the rest of that story there too. Then I skip down to paragraph 8 and for the rest of it at the end of the story here. And you can kind of practice reading that. I'm going to give you a little bit of that, and we'll talk about it, because he describes events that correspond exactly with the events that we see in chapters 16. And we'll look at those next week and see how they compare. When you look at what's in chapter 16, it looks very, very symbolic. But when you realize how the battle went, you can correspond these to things that Josephus said. And there's one other key thing about chapter 16 as you read it. And that is, the events that happened to the Jews here correspond to events in the Old Testament where they were protected from God's selective destruction of the enemy, and a lot of it at the time of the Exodus. So whereas there were sores upon the Egyptians, the Jews didn't get the sores. And where they were, they got the frogs, all right, but they didn't get many of the later plagues that were brought upon the Egyptians didn't happen to the Jews. Now God unleashes these things that have been held all of these centuries against the Jews because of their rebellion against him. And that's the story in chapter 16. So we'll look at that in some detail next week. And then in the following week, we'll look at the aftermath of all of it in chapter 17 and 18 of Revelation. Any comments or questions about this? We want you to meet a couple of our friends here, Larry and Ruth Walker visiting with us. And we're happy to have you all here. They're from the Northland, Lubbock, is that right? Yeah, okay. Let me give you these announcements. Nancy Stuckey had shoulder replacement surgery this morning. She's doing well and may come.